Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson this Monday morning. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me is my esteemed executive assistant, Morgan Murphy. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
And thank you, Matt Neely, for all you do for us. You keep us on track and keep us going here on these bright and early Monday mornings and Friday mornings. And with our other hosts, we have Ted Maxwell on Engagement Tuesday, Grant Kruger hosts Food for Thoughts Wednesday, and Tom Moulton hosts Southern Arizona Traction, sponsored by Visit Tucson on Thursdays. And I come back next coming couple days here and talk about success stories on Friday. So Monday is all about wonder at the University of Arizona. We talk about the good things going on, the research, the outcomes, the students. And Morgan, you're just about wrapping up here for the semester, your first half of your marketing master's degree, and then you'll start again in January and go for another 5 months and then graduate with a master's in marketing. Kind of fun, huh?
Yes, very excited.
Stressful time of
very
the year.
Very stressful.
Finals and all those things. It's pretty amazing. Well, one of the things, you know, talking about timing and how, you know, Christmas is on us and it just seems so compressed and everything. Man, when you start talking about the solar system and talking about space and the universe and distances and time and so forth, a couple of days is a nanosecond in compared to what. So with us today is Dr. A.J. Timothy Joel. He's a professor emeritus in the geosciences department at the University of Arizona. Still publishing, because you've just come out with a paper and with a co-author to talk about something really unique, which is the title of it is When Trees Talk, Researchers Probe Ancient Wood for Clues About Massive Solar Storms. So good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here this morning. So let's start with the basics. This research has to do with solar flares and how the sun emits these flares and how that affects the solar system, if you will. And of course, the Earth is in the solar system, so these solar flares can affect Earth. So what is a solar flare?
So a solar flare is an ejection of protons, which are atomic particles, from the sun. They tend to occur more during solar maximum, which is sort of right now. And most people know that the sun has an 11-year cycle, so that's a very small effect in solar flares in general. So these particles are ejected. If they hit the Earth, they cause disruption of the magnetic field. They cause aurora. So many people may have heard of aurora occurring this year.
Right. Beautiful northern lights are beautiful, but they also can be affecting of communications and other things, right?
That's right. They can affect radio communications, for example, and they could affect air traffic, because planes don't like to fly over the North Pole when there's a lot of solar flare activity.
Right, right. So these solar flares then that are emitted from the sun, they happen, although they happen regularly, they don't happen on a regular schedule or anything. They just are, they just explode like a firecracker, boom, off they go. And so it's not regular, but it is regular, right?
Okay, there's a regular portion of it, mm-hmm. which occurs, as I said, with 11-year cycle. And mm-hmm. then there are much larger events that happen apparently randomly. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're interested in, because the small events, we can't really see them in the radiocarbon signal that we look for in tree rings. So.
Right. So what your study looked at then was major solar flares, and we have, as I said, over the last 14,500 years, you detect maybe six major events, solar flare major events, which were huge, right?
Yeah, these flares are very large. The largest observed solar flare occurred in 1956, which was, well, much bigger than usual. And there was another one in 1972, and there's been several that caused major power outages. There was one in 1989 that affected the power in New York State, for example.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And these very large ones, there are probably more of them than we document, because we've only documented the ones where we had both the signal from tree rings and from ice cores.
Right, right. And so you have a co-author with you, Irina Panyushinka. Panushkina. Okay. And she's in the Laboratory for Tree Ring Research, and you're out of the Department of Geosciences. It's interesting that you've combined geosciences and tree ring research to kind of triangulate, if you will, this research. That's very interesting.
Well, there's always been a close connection between geosciences and tree ring at the University of Arizona. So that was a natural fit, and I've worked in radiocarbon dating, which most people vaguely know what that is.
Right.
And I can explain that if you want.
But in essence, what is novel about U of A's laboratory tree ring research lab? It's one of the biggest ones in the world, if it's not the premier one in the world, right?
It's one of the biggest. I think it may be the biggest. There are a couple of other ones in Europe that are similar, but the tree ring lab has, I think, like a million pieces of wood.
Right.
And they have a nice building where you can go and look at the tree rings. I think they have tours on Wednesdays.
Yeah, it's right under the stadium. The west, the east side of the stadium is where...
They have a new building.
The new building, right.
It used to be in the stadium.
Yeah. Used to be in the stadium years ago. That's dating myself. That's when I went to school back there is where it was. But this whole technology then of what you're looking at is you're taking samples of wood that would have recorded these solar flares, the six major ones or other ones dating back as many as 14,000 years ago. You're able then to determine through carbon dating and so forth the effect of that or the when this happened in the history of...
So I can try and explain that. So usually when we do radiocarbon dating, we measure how much radiocarbon is left and we use that to calculate the age. So in this case, we know the age of this material because there are tree rings and they've been counted. And so then we kind of see how much carbon-14 is there, and that allows us to then back calculate if there was too much carbon-14 or not enough.
Interesting. And that's how you're determining what kind of a solar flare then would have occurred.
So then you can do some kind of modeling to figure out how big the solar flare was, for example.
Right.
And in the case of one of the largest ones is in 774 AD, which is well documented, and you can read about it on the internet, actually.
Right.
That was probably something like 100 times the flare in 1956, which is
huge in and of itself.
Which is already huge, right?
Yeah.
And so the other interesting point is that it's well known that in 1859 there was a very large geomagnetic event.
And that had to do with solar flares as well, right?
That had to do with solar flares, but you cannot see that in this T14 record, carbon-14 record.
When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about what tree rings and ice have in common and how you're using this to kind of see these solar flares in the history of tree rings and ice. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. Morgan Murphy is with me in studio. Morgan, I know you roll your eyes occasionally when I tell dad jokes, but since we're talking about solar flares, I thought I would say something. I would say that I am so bright. My dad always called me son.
That's a good one.
That's my solar flare joke for the day. That was pretty bad, pretty bad, pretty bad. With us in studio is Dr. Timothy Jewell, a professor emeritus in the Geosciences Department at the University of Arizona. He and a colleague and some others have just published a paper that says, When Trees Talk, Researchers Probe Ancient Wood for Clues About Massive Solar Storms, and talking about solar flares and how can they can affect life here on Earth when the sun emits its protons and they are aimed at Earth. What happens? We get the beautiful aurora that we see in the northern lights and so forth. We see some things as they affect with even the human eye. But you are looking at tree rings and ice. So what is the combination? What is the historical record that's contained both in tree rings and in ice? And how did you put those two together?
Okay, well, we know that tree rings make annual rings. Most trees in the temperate part of the world make annual rings.
And that's how you count how old they are, by counting those rings, right?
You can see the annual rings, and actually there's usually early and late wood, but in any case, everybody knows you can see tree rings. And if you took a slice of a tree, you would probably see that there's a solar cycle there, because mm-hmm. you can see that the rings vary in width over 11 years or so. Yeah.
So in 22 years on a tree, you can see the swing from the one 11-year period to the other 11-year
exactly,
period, and
yes.
you can actually count that by counting the rings.
You can count that. So if I was to look at the carbon-14 in those rings over 11 years, the effect is very, very small, maybe mm-hmm. Two parts in 1,000 or something like that.
So it's very minimal, but it is recorded in those rings.
It's recorded, right. And so then we see these giant events, which are much bigger. They're about at least 10 times more, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells us that the carbon-14 in the atmosphere in that year was much higher, because the tree's recording what's in the atmosphere. The tree's taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere to make cellulose. That's what trees do, right? So that's how we figure that out.
And so these solar flares, especially the gigantic ones, can actually kind of change the atmosphere's chemistry a little bit, and because it's injecting these protons and this stuff into the atmosphere of the Earth and the ionosphere and so forth, and creating creating its own little weather, basically.
Yeah, so it's also important to know that so that these protons, when they hit the Earth, they get deflected towards the polar region. So if you have a very large flare, it does have some effect on ionization in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And also that can cause, apparently people have modeled that it causes small changes in climate. It's particularly in the polar regions. So
interesting. And so as this is deflected to the North Pole and the South Pole, and then the ice kind of serves as a, over time, serves as kind of like a tree ring at the polar caps, and it's laying on layer on layer on layer. And when they take an ice look at the ice cores, they can see this kind of similar buildup of this
right.
effect, right?
I mean, they have lots of ice cores have been collected. They have annual layers mm-hmm. that are identified in various ways, but yes, you're basically using it in the same way as you use tree rings.
So it's an interesting use of natural progression of time, being marked by this annual layering of snow and ice and so forth, but also the growth of a tree. As it grows, it gives its rings. And you put those two things together, and you can kind of see, authenticate some of these major storms that you've seen in the data. You can prove that by saying, here it is in the tree ring, and here it is in the ice core as well.
Right. So we have more spikes in the carbon-14 record than we've actually said are actually documented events, because mm-hmm. we haven't proven it by seeing the same event in ice cores.
Right.
But that work, that's detailed work, because you have to get the right ice cores, and that's a whole other process.
Yeah. So now you're working on trying to match those kind of things up so that you can validate the carbon-14 testing in both of those different samples, right?
Yes. And we're also looking for other trees where we think there might be spikes. I mean, it's kind of like a fishing expedition, if
right.
you want to think about it that way.
Yeah. Ice fishing.
Or tree ring fishing.
Tree ring fishing, yeah. So, you know, just in general, why should an average listener, why should I care about solar flares? Why in my little life that I have, in a blink of an eye in the universe and the time that we have, short time on Earth here, why should I care about solar flares, and why are you studying them?
Well, we know that large solar flares cause all kinds of electrical and geomagnetic problems on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We know that it obviously, there's more radiation, so if you're flying in an aircraft at 30,000, 40,000 feet, especially over the poles, you would get much more radiation. And mm-hmm. For example, they already document how much radiation air crews get in mm-hmm. general, for long flights in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we know that there have been like power outages, which are caused by large solar flares. There was one in 1989, which knocked out most of the power grid in New York State, because the power is coming from Quebec, northern Quebec,
mm-hmm.
and these flares blew out some of the transformers in the transmission system. There were other previous similar events, and as I was going to say before, in 1859 there was a giant geomagnetic event, which is called the Carrington event, and this caused massive changes in the geomagnetic field of something like 30-40% in in less than an hour. This is really amazing. And it caused massive electrical disruption. So you have to understand, in 1859, electrical disruptions are like your telegraph wires have corona around them and things like that.
Right.
And
And today's technology, we're all electrified and computerized and digitized and so forth. A major outage could be a significant. It could bring an economy to a halt if you don't have the grid working right.
Well, we not just that, but we all rely on cell phones and
GPS,
satellite phones, GPS.
Right.
All that would be wiped out.
Right.
And the satellites would probably be dead. And so, if you imagine, like, even if I come to your studio, it's hard to find, so I use the GPS,
right?
And that all relies on talking to some satellites in space, right?
Right, right. And so it does affect human existence, because the solar flares then do affect how we live our lives. And so understanding, again, you can't predict necessarily when a big, giant, massive solar flare is going to happen, but it's going to happen at some point in the future. It will happen, but when is probably not predictable, right?
When is not exactly predictable. We know that the last very big one was over 1,000 years ago, and we think the probability of these events is something of the order of 1,000 years at the
best case. So we're getting close then, maybe. It could be another 1,000 years, but we're probably getting close.
It could happen tomorrow.
yeah. So we're talking with Dr. Timothy Jewell. He is a professor emeritus in the Geosciences Department at the University of Arizona, talking about how trees and ice talk, how researchers have probed both wood and ice cores for clues about massive solar storms and solar flares and the disruption that they might have caused in our Earth's history, but also in our current life and sometime in the future. Some of these flares, if it's a big one, could cause some havoc here on Earth with human existence and so forth. So what is the trajectory now of your research? You've done this research in carbon-14 data and so forth. What are you looking at for the future? What are you guys going to do in terms of what's the next step in this research?
Well, the next step is to find the rest of the spikes. I mean, first of all, we know there are more there. Our colleagues in Japan, Miyake et al., for example, already know there's one or two more. Mm-hmm. And also, these spikes can be used going backwards again for dating things. So if we have an object that has, a log from, 700 AD or so, and it has the rings from a large spike that occurred in 774, then we have a spike that tells us exactly the year that object was made, because we can then count back to the outer edge of the log, for example.
Right, right. And some of these obviously are fossilized tree rings too, right? Because a tree doesn't last for, some do, some last for 2,000 years, but most trees have a limited lifespan, right? So you're looking at wood that's been dated because it's not growing anymore, perhaps, depending on the sample.
Yeah, most trees last maybe 150, 200 years. There's some trees that last longer. In the tree ring lab, it's a big collection of trees from bristlecone pine, which are coming from the White Mountains of California. Some of those trees last for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And other records come from European oaks, which last maybe 150 years or so, but they're buried in bogs, and then you can reconstruct the chronology from lots of different trees, right?
All right. Do you enjoy this work of solving these puzzles of carbon dating kind of trying to pinpoint when these things? Is this kind of a fun thing for you to do as a professor emeritus in the geosciences department?
Absolutely.
Yeah, a lifelong commitment to trying to figure that out.
I've been working in this field for over 40 years. So.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes.
Well, we appreciate your service to the university and teaching students over the years. You've a fascinating story about how we use tree rings and ice cores to kind of give us a semblance of what solar flares and solar storms have done to the universe. Pretty fascinating, huh? Don't you think so, Morgan? That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it's insane. It's pretty cool.
U of A is a wonderful place, and that's why we celebrate wonder. Thank you so much. We appreciate you coming, Dr. Timothy Jewell from the Professor Emeritus of Geosciences Department at the University of Arizona.
Thank you.
We'll be back after the break, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me in studio is Morgan Murphy, my executive assistant. Good morning, Morgan.
Good morning.
I didn't demote you from CEO to executive assistant, but I thought I'd start using your appropriate title. So
that's fair.
Yeah, thanks for being here. And thanks for setting up our guest again today. This is kind of Astronomy Day on Jump in Tucson on the Monday Wonder Series. We talked a little bit about satellites in the sky and how we track those and what's in what parking spot in geo orbit. And in this segment, we're going to talk with Andras Gaspar. He is Associate Research Professor at Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you have a fascinating, some research that you're doing, but before we get to that, let's ask you a little bit about your educational journey and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Oh, well, that starts way back when I was a young boy. The listeners may be able to identify that I have a little bit of an accent, so I actually wasn't born here. I was born and raised in Hungary, so I grew up there, and I was already really interested in physics at a young age and went to astronomy camps and so on. And that led me to be even more interested in astronomy, and I got an undergraduate degree in astronomy in Hungary, and from there on, I got into graduate school here at the University of Arizona in 2006.
I want you to say a sentence in Hungarian. Just say something. Happy Thanksgiving to you all in Hungarian. I'd just be interested in hearing how you say it. Just say something in Hungarian.
Boldog hálaadás mindenkinek.
Very cool. Very cool. You have a great English command of the English language as well. Well, what's your responsibility at the U of A? You're associate research professor at the Stewart Observatory, but what does that mean? What are you doing at the U of A?
So, as I said, I've been here since 2006, so I've gone through the entire range from graduate student to postdoc through assistant to now associate astronomer. And my primary
responsibility
is that I'm a member of the JWST science instrument teams. We have two instrument teams here at the University of Arizona. One of them is the NIRCam instrument team, and the other one is the mid-infrared instrument science team. These are two detectors on the James Webb Space Telescope, and the near-infrared camera, the main detector on the Space Observatory, is actually LED here at the Stewart Observatory, so the principal investigator on that is Marsha Rieke, and the U.S. science team lead for the mid-infrared instrument is George Rieke, and I've been working with them since 2006, and as a member of the science instrument teams, we helped actually test the instruments and then commission them after launch.
Right. So Tucson's been known over the last 100 years as a great place for observing stars from land-based telescopes, not only at the Stewart Observatory and up on Mount Lemmon and Mount Bigelow and Mount Graham and Kitt Peak and all the other places that we have telescopes around here and the beautiful skies that we have. But a real game changer for astronomy was when the Hubble Space Telescope was launched several years ago, and now most recently the James Webb Telescope. These are amazing instruments that are out there, and the resolution that they're, the distance that they're looking is just amazing, isn't it?
That's right, and so the University of Arizona is leader in ground-based observing, as you've said, but we've also been leaders in space-based observing. So one of the instruments on the Hubble Space Telescope, which is not working now, NICMOS, was actually built here at the University of Arizona. And you didn't mention the Spitzer Space Telescope, which was one of our other very large projects. The MIPS instrument on Spitzer was built here at the University of Arizona, and the principal investigator of that instrument was George Rieke, my current boss.
That's fantastic. So right now, these you've been able to tap into these telescopes and do an in-depth look at a nearly, this blew me away when you told me this, 100 billion mile diameter debris disk encircling Vega.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's a pretty big disk. And Vega is a very famous star. So if you look up at a night sky, especially in the summertime when it's really visible, you can see Vega. It's the brightest star you'll see in the summer night sky. So if you look up, there's a very bright star. It's going to be Vega, probably the one you're looking at. And it's very close to us, and it's a very luminous, hot star. And because of that, it's been a star that astronomers have used for a very long time as a standard star. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it's not really a good source to use as a standard because it's got this whopping big disk around it.
Right. And it is bright for, like you said, for two reasons. It's closer.
That's right.
Than most other stars. And it is just an luminous, it illuminates a lot of energy. And
that's
so
right.
That's a bright star to begin
that's
with.
That's right.
But it's also closer. That's why it's so bright in the sky.
Yeah. So it's an A-type star, and it's about 40 times more luminous than our sun.
Which is pretty bright.
It's pretty bright.
Yeah. And so how far is 100 billion miles? I mean, that's just mind-boggling to even think about that.
It is. So put it in terms, the disk's peak is at about 100 astronomical units away from us, mm-hmm. which is one astronomical unit is the average distance between the sun and the Earth. Mm-hmm. So it's quite large. Yeah.
Right. So it's an amazing, I just fascinated by the distances that we're dealing with in the universe and so forth. So what is this dust debris that's circling Vega? What is it made of?
So let's go back a little bit in history because it's actually really interesting. So as I said, Vega is a standard star, has been for a long time. And because of this, it was used as a calibrator source for the very first infrared space observatory, the IRIS Space Observatory, which went up in 1983.
Right.
And they looked at Vega as one of the six calibrator sources they wanted to use to get their brightness system calibrated. And it turned out that something funky was going on with this star. It was way brighter in the infrared wavelengths than it should have been, just based on if it was a pure star. So that was when this very first debris disk was found, by happenstance of using the star as a calibrator source. And right after that, that observatory actually found a few dozen other similar systems. But to answer your question, what is this? Well, these are leftover planetesimals, basically, that still orbit the star, that are left over from the period of planetary system formation. But this is an old star. It's a mature star. It's about 400 million years old, which is actually quite old for a very luminous star that Vega is.
And so the stuff that's in the disk is this planetary dust and debris that's left over from, didn't form into star, into planets.
That's right.
It just still resting there. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what we see a little bit around Saturn and similar, but not exactly the same.
Sort of. The better analogy is the asteroid belt and the Kuiper belt around the sun.
Gotcha.
And that's exactly what we're seeing, except our sun is old, so our Kuiper and asteroid belts have been able to grind themselves down. And what we actually see around all of these systems is the tiniest dust particles that are produced through these collisions of the small planetesimals that are left over.
That's great. And so we call this a ring of dust.
That's
and,
right.
So the infrared Spitzer Space Telescope then mapped out this ring, and other telescopes also looked at it and so forth. What makes looking at this information different from other rings of dust that we're seeing? What are you seeing that's different from other things that are similar?
So you need to understand first the difference between Spitzer and JWST. Yeah. A lot of people, so JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, is the big new thing, right?
Right.
And people like to call it the successor of Hubble, but in reality, it's the successor of Spitzer because they are the ones that are observing the same wavelength range. The Hubble Space Telescope observes at visible wavelength range, so the wavelength ranges that we see with our own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Spitzer and JWST observes at much longer wavelengths where bodies are able to actually emit from their own thermal emission. So JWST would be able to see you and I as we're standing here glowing.
Mm-hmm.
Hubble observes in scatterlight. So the Hubble Space Telescope observed the tiniest dust particles as they're scattering light off their surfaces. So imagine someone puffing a cigarette and you see the smoke, and the smoke scattering the sun's light off of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Hubble's able to see. With JWST, we actually see them glowing from their own temperature, basically.
Wow.
So you're seeing slightly larger particles and different characteristics of the particles. So Hubble was fantastic, and it still is fantastic, at observing the scatter light of the smallest dust particles. Spitzer came along and was really good at observing the glow of these dust particles, but Spitzer was smaller. Mm-hmm. Spitzer's diameter is about 1 meter, 80 centimeters to be exact. JWST's diameter is 6.8 meters. So it's almost 10 times as big,
right,
which means its resolution is about 10 times better.
Fascinating. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about the detail we see from the James Webb Telescope and the Spitzer Telescope and the distances that we're dealing with here, which are amazing and always fascinating. We'll come back and we'll talk with Andras Gaspar, Associate Research Professor at the Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. Astronomy Day at the Jump in Tucson on the Wonder Series for Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. The sky is full of stars, and this is kind of the astronomy hour on Jump in Tucson on this Monday. We're talking about WONDER, the great research and information going on that's telling us lots of stuff about who we are, where we are in the universe. And we're speaking, just want to say welcome back again to Morgan Murphy, my executive
assistant.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And our guest is Andras Gaspar. He is Associate Research Professor at the Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. So you had mentioned before the break that we have just seen some incredible detail from both Spitzer, but also from the James Webb Telescope. It's amazing the detail that you're able to see. It's kind of like you said, the analogy of smoke rising from a cigar or cigarette, and being able to see that and see what's reflecting off of that, and seeing these bodies emit this energy that you can see. It's pretty fascinating. Who would have known, 200 years ago that we'd have this telescope in space that can show us some things that is a kind of the definition of why are we here and what's out there?
Yeah, JWST has really increased our perspective on our world, absolutely.
Yeah. So, again, I go back to these distances that we're talking about. We're talking about this star being 10 astronomical units away from Earth, right?
Did you say? No, the star itself is about 40 light years from us.
40 light years, okay.
But the disk around it is about 100 astronomical units.
So that's right. Pretty amazing, isn't it, those distances? That's a huge, huge, huge area.
It is, and the interesting thing is now we can actually compare these to how our solar system looks like, right? Mm-hmm. That's the main point of all of this research, is to understand our own world in context of what we're seeing out there, how easy it is to form planetary systems, and how our solar system compares to others. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep in mind, as we said, Vega is extremely luminous. Mm-hmm. And that means you have to upscale everything. So the outer belt here that we see can be analogous to the Kuiper belt around our solar system. That's much closer. That's about 40 astronomical units away. And so all of that scales up because of the large temperature and brightness, luminosity of Vega.
Could there be, obviously there are other researchers are looking at this probably, but could there be planetary systems that are closer into Vega that we can't see because it's so bright and we can't see them? And, they obviously the planetary thing has to move in front of the star from our point of view or from Webb's point of view or whatever. Do we know if there's exoplanets out there circling around Vega? We don't, maybe not.
So Vega has one potential possible exoplanet around it, but it's not certain. And the interesting part of the JWST observations of this particular system is that the disk seems to be extremely smooth, mm-hmm. and spread out without any structure in it. And you ask what differentiates these observations from the previous ones? Well, this is what differentiates it. With this increased resolution, we're able to try to find structures in the system, but we don't see any,
right?
Which hints at the fact that this system does not have any massive planets in it. So it's different from the solar system, right? The solar system has the four main gas giants that are massive in the outer regions. Mm-hmm. It seems Vega doesn't have any of that.
Right. And so this dust might be the things that could have been made into planets, but they didn't get made into planets, and they're just smooth out there.
Sort of like that, yeah. So the outer regions has these planetesimals that are continuously colliding, producing the smallest dust particles that we can see. And what we think is happening is, since there are no planets to really interfere with them,
as what you called in the article, snow plowing their way through the dust, right?
So they're slowly migrating inwards, and then meeting with the star and sublimating, but it results in this very homogeneous, even smooth disk surface.
But this moving towards the planet takes millions of years, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Long time.
Long
time. At least from out here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, especially from those distances into the star.
Exactly.
And who knows how long the star will be around. I guess they
not a long time. Yeah. So Vega, since it's a very luminous star, it's going to end its life in a few hundred million years.
It's churning through its fuel is what
that's
it's doing, right?
Right?
So its life, because it's so bright, its lifespan will be
exactly
shorter than what a normal...
Did you take an astronomy course at the U of A?
I'm just fascinated by the distances and what is happening out there. It's amazing. So there's still a lot of unknowns in planet formation, and these observations are helping us to kind of understand, which is maybe one of the major focuses of foci of astronomy, is how did we get here? And how did our Earth get here? And how did we get formed? And why are we here? This is kind of helping us answer those questions.
Absolutely. So exoplanet research has been booming, right? We found the very first exoplanet in 1995. And since then, we've found over 5,000 exoplanets around other stars, which is amazing. But most of them are not similar to what we're accustomed to seeing around our sun. Why? Well, because there are probably selection effects. We're much more easily able to detect very massive planets orbiting very close to their stars with our current indirect methods of observing exoplanets.
So when you were a little kid getting interested in astronomy, did you ever think you'd be working on the James Webb telescope and looking out into the star Vega, the brightest star that you saw from your backyard? And amazing.
No, but JWST wasn't planned. Really. Right. The first plans,
They did it for you.
That's right. The first plans came out in 2000, I think, around JWST.
Right.
So it was a long project.
So what's your future in astronomy? You're working on this project now, but what are you hoping to do in your research in the coming years?
We hope to study these and other systems in even more greater detail using JWST.
And is there another version of the James Webb telescope in the next 30 years? Will there be another one that goes out that they're working on now?
Well, the big one that's under consideration right now is the Habitable Worlds Observatory, which is directly aimed at looking at a few dozen sources where they're trying to find habitable worlds. So planets that are similar in size and shape to Earth.
In that habitable zone behind their stars, yeah, to get there. And if we need to move someday.
We wouldn't be able to do that.
it would take a wormhole in the fabric of space in order to get us there, right?
Yeah, but it would be comforting to know, right?
Yeah, it would
that
be comforting other... to know. Yeah. Well, this is fascinating research that you have, and thank you for sharing with us this morning. We hope that you stick around the University of Arizona and stay here and continue to do the great research that you and your team are doing on Vega and other things out in the universe. It's just fascinating. It's the most fascinating thing I can think of. So,
well, thank you for saying that and for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Coming up on Tuesday, Ted Maxwell hosts the Engagement Hour on Tuesday. He does that, and he engages with civic leaders and so forth. It's a great program. Grant Kruger will be here on Wednesday with his take on food for thought. He talks about restaurants and civic engagement from that perspective. Tom Moulton is here on Thursday, thanks to our good friends at Visit Tucson. We thank Felipe and Graham for supporting us here. And Tom talks about the attractions that the people come from all over the world to see. Those 7 million people are coming here for a reason. And part of it is to see the stuff down at the U of A and the astronomy that's going on there. And I'll be back on Friday with some success stories about organizations and businesses that are doing well. And then the following Monday, we'll be back with our friends from the University of Arizona with the Wonder Series. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson and share your success story, go to jumpintucson.com. Let us know a little bit about you, and who knows, maybe you'll be live on the air. You have a great, fantastic week, Morgan. So thank you for being here this morning.
Of course.
You do great work. We appreciate you scheduling our guests this morning. And Dr. Gaspar, we just want to thank you for your good work at the University of Arizona. And thank you for being here on Jump in Tucson. We appreciate it.
Thank you once again.
Okay, great. You're listening to Jump in Tucson, which broadcasts from the Bustos Media Studios at KVOI 1030 AM radio. We appreciate you being here and listening to all the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. We call it wonder because there's so many wonderful things happening, especially in astronomy. We wonder what's out there, and it's cool to see researchers telling us what is out there. You're listening to KVOI Radio, and we hope that you jump in Tucson.